The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Backblaze. Get peace of mind knowing your files are backed up securely in the cloud. Get a free 15-day trial at backblaze.com/paranormal. That's backblaze.com/paranormal. Thanks, Backblaze. Also, the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S., a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. So, go to clubw.com/gym and get $20 off your first order when you become a new member. Again, that's clubw.com/gym. Thanks, Club W.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and I am so excited because we've got another two-parter for you today on the Paranormal Podcast. We start off with one of my favorite authors in the whole area of Fortiana. I'm talking about the prolific Nick Redfern. He's going to talk to us about not men, but women in black. Ooh, spooky stuff. And then also, in part two, we're going to have Joshua Shapiro appear, and he's going to talk about those strange crystal skulls that have been found all over the world. A creepy subject that has fascinated me, well, I guess since I was a kid, and looking forward to learning more. So there we are, a big two-parter paranormal podcast, and here it is. Our guest today is not a stranger to the programs. In fact, he's been on many times because he has written many great books. And this one is no exception. You know, when we think about the subject of men in black, that's what we think of, men. But what about if there are women in black? Well, Nick Redfern addresses that question in his recent book, Women in Black, The Creepy Companions of the Mysterious MIB. Now, if you've been in a cave and don't know who he is, Nick Redfern is a journalist who writes on a wide range of subjects, including Bigfoot, UFOs, and paranormal phenomena. I can't even count how many books he's done at this point, but he's constantly coming out with new and great books. He's appeared on many television programs, such as The Monster Project, Monster Quest, and Proof Positive. He's the author, again, of many books. He writes for various blogs, including his own, Mysterious Universe. He also writes for JimHarold.com and our Paranormal Brain Trust section, and he lives in Dallas, Texas. Nick, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on again.
So, Women in Black, how did this come to your attention? Because I hadn't really heard much about Women in Black. How'd you discover it?
Well, actually, most people haven't actually heard about it. But what happened, and I guess happens with most authors, you know, if you write a book on a specific topic, people who've had their own experiences contact you. And over the years, I've written 3 books on the Men in Black mystery. And so I get a lot of feedback from people who've had encounters with the MIB. But what's interesting is that perhaps for every 20 or so reports that I get of the Men in Black, I get sort of 2 or 3 where it was either a woman in black or it was a man and a woman in black. And so, in other words, you know, I probably wouldn't have been able to write the book had it not been for the feedback coming in from, you know, people who wanted to share their stories. And so that's really how it happened. And of course, you know, it took quite a while before I could write the book because, you know, the reports trickled in over the course of the last 10 years. So that's actually how long I've been thinking about the book. And it was only really this year that I was at a point to have enough material to sort of justify putting a book out.
Now, what do these women in black look like? Do they present themselves just like men in black, except they're female, or are there some differences? What do people report seeing?
Well, it is actually pretty much the same, Jim. They wear like a black outfit, like a woman's black business outfit, that kind of thing. But also, like the men in black, they have this sort of odd appearance in the sense that their skin is usually very pale and they're sort of extremely emotionless. And they have these sort of penetrating eyes that some witnesses have said seem slightly bigger than normal. And that's something that gets reported in a lot of the Men in Black cases as well. And even the way they act, you know, they turn is the same as the MIB. They pretty much turn up mainly at night and try to find a way into the home with all sorts of weird excuses. Sometimes they pretend to be census takers, that kind of thing. But then they start asking questions about the paranormal, and then the person wonders what's happening, and then they realize that there's something else going on. So, in other words, everything about them is pretty much identical, except you've got, you know, one's female, one's male. It really is that simple, I guess.
Now, is there a certain set of circumstances where these women in black present themselves as opposed to men in black? Do they tend to target women more? Do they tend to target men more? Does there seem to be something that triggers the appearance of a woman in black as opposed to men in black, or is it just totally random?
Well, that's actually a good question. One of the really interesting things is that there are a lot of reports where the women in black have turned up in relation to contactee cases. Now, in today's world, you know, the whole issue of the excuse me, of the contactees, who really sort of were at their height in the 50s and 60s, a lot of people, even in ufology, unfortunately, dismiss those stories today, preferring to deal with abductions, you know, and landing cases. And but if you look back into the history of the subject, in the 50s and 60s, you know, the contactee movement was huge. For example, George Van Tassel, he used to put a yearly conference on in Giant Rock, California, out in the desert. And at its height, he was getting like 12,000 attendees at the conference, which is unheard of today. So it demonstrates the sort of sheer power that the contactees had back then. I think I've got 6 or 7 cases in the book of people who had had close encounters with a UFO, which had landed, and there was interaction between the entities, very human-looking entities, and the witnesses. And in typical scenarios, you know, they would be given a message to share with the world, that kind of thing, sort of concerns about nuclear weapons and things like that. And I've got a number of cases in the book where contactees had been visited by women in black afterwards and essentially told not to talk about this, which is sort of curious, because a lot of people have suggested, because the women in black look strange, that they are themselves aliens. And if that's the case, what we have is obviously sort of one group of aliens speaking to people and then another group which are trying to silence people, which is sort of very bizarre. But there's no doubt that there's a sort of a trend runs through all this when it comes to the contactees and the women in black.
Now, is there any time when women will, you know, we think of guys of having one set of, and some people may view this as sexist, but so be it. I hope that's not the case. I don't mean it that way. But, you know, maybe men are more intimidating or they're rougher or those kind of things, where women might be seemed more empathetic or more relatable, more approachable, and maybe even the case if it's a man, maybe they're using their womanly wiles, quote, their womanly wiles, to kind of sway a man to a certain way. Is there any techniques that these women in black tend to use that are specific to women?
Well, that's a good question as well. I would actually say there really isn't, because, you know, there's no attempt to sort of calm the person or reassure them. It's just sort of as chilling as disturbing for the witnesses as it was for those who saw the men in black. You know, they, as I said, they're totally unemotional. They make these sort of veiled threats, and the atmosphere that they give off, and the vibe that they give off, really sort of creeps people out to the point where, you know, they just want this person to go. So in other words, there's no sort of soft approach to it at all. No. But what you do find is that, as I said, whereas the men in black, there are a lot of weird reports where they seem to control the minds of the witnesses to allow them into the house or the apartment or wherever. But with the women in black, that, as I said, they pose as other people. They don't sort of have this sort of hypnotic, or at least they don't use it very often, this hypnotic angle of trying to find a way in the home. Instead, what they do is, as I said, they pretend to be like a census taker or somebody who's taking a poll in the area of something, and the people don't think anything about it. You know, they've let them in, and as I said, then it starts to get into weirder questions along the lines of, have you had any strange experiences in the last few weeks? And when this starts, then the witnesses begin to realize that what the woman in black is talking about is a real UFO encounter they had perhaps a few weeks earlier. And then they'll say something like, you know, can I take a look at that ID card again? And then sometimes, you know, the women in black will make their excuses and leave, or they'll just increase the sort of the menacing atmosphere, and then they come out and, you know, they sort of put their cards on the table, and the person realizes that they're being silenced because of their UFO encounter. But the other big difference between the men in black and the women in black is that whereas the men in black predominantly turn up only in relation to UFO encounters, I've got some very bizarre stories where women in black had turned up in relation to things like chupacabra sightings, Bigfoot reports, and, you know, strange creatures, that kind of thing.
Well, that kind of lends credence to the idea that all of these things are connected. You know, we've always looked, for the longest time, we've looked at things as very siloed. UFOs over here, cryptid creatures over there, ghosts in this other area. And it seems as we go on, there seems to be less siloing and maybe some kind of connection. You look at the work of somebody like Stan Gordon and Bigfoot and UFOs and so forth. Seems like there seems to be more cross-pollination. And I guess you would be one of the best people to talk about that, because you do cover so many different areas. Do you feel that's the case?
Well, yeah. I mean, over the years, even before I started looking into the whole issue of the women in black, I occasionally got reports of people who had been told not to talk about their cryptid sightings. For example, back in England, you know, we have a lot of reports of what are known as the alien big cats, or ABCs, where people report these large black cats somewhere in the region of the size of like an American mountain lion, you know, so that they're really big. But of course, the situation generally is that the government says, well, there's nothing to these stories, and it's just people mistaking overfed house cats or whatever, you know, or the occasional sort of feral cat perhaps. But most of the witnesses are absolutely sure that what they saw was, you know, a huge cat along the lines of like, sort of like a black leopard or something like that. And I used to get occasional reports where somebody said they were visited by somebody from the one of the agricultural offices of the British government and said, you know, we'd prefer you didn't talk about this. But they came across just like regular government employees. But in the book, I've got a number of cases of people who'd seen these black cats and were visited by what you can only call these sort of classic women in black, and who in some cases, you know, said, you won't talk about this, and others where it was actually quite a relaxed situation because the witnesses didn't really pick up on the menacing side of things. They just remembered that the woman sort of looked strange. And they also thought it strange that they were going really out of their way to ensure that the person did not say anything about this. And you're right, Stan Gordon's got a number of cases like this in relation to Bigfoot and Men in Black. And so in other words, we're seeing, I think, sort of a very under-investigated aspect of cryptozoology, which I think probably, you know, if somebody were to spend the time, they might be able to find, you know, massive amounts of information where witnesses to cryptids had been silenced. I mean, I'm guessing, but it's a good suspicion, I think, that the ones I've got are just the tip of the iceberg, really.
Our guest is Nick Redfern. The subject are Women in Black, the creepy companions of the mysterious MIB, and we'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Backblaze. Get peace of mind knowing your files are backed up securely in the cloud. Get a free 15-day trial at backblaze.com/paranormal. That's backblaze.com/paranormal. I got to tell you, if you are using a computer for anything of any importance these days, backup is key. There's so many different things out there that can happen. You could have physical destruction. A hard drive can fail. You could have theft from your home. You could have fire. Just horrible, horrible things can happen. And there is a cure, though. Effective backups. An effective backup strategy. And that's where my friends over at Backblaze come in. Because think about it. Now, I know many of you say, Jim, I've got that covered. I've got an external hard drive sitting right by my computer. Or I have, if I'm an Apple person, I've got the Time Machine, which is a great feature, no doubt. But what if something happens to those physical drives? God forbid. What if there's a lightning strike and it fries everything connected to your electrical grid at your home? Or, God forbid, there is a theft. Or, even worse yet, a fire. And all those precious photos and all that precious information, personal information, it's all lost if that physical drive does not exist. And that's why you have to have offsite backup, and Backblaze is the painless way to do it. Right now, if you go over to backblaze.com/paranormal, that's backblaze.com/paranormal, you can get a 15-day free trial. And after that, if you like it, it's only $5 a month. Now think about this. Think about all the photos you have of your kids. Think about all the crucial data you have on your PC or Mac. And think if it were gone, poof, no hope of getting it back. You couldn't get it back. Now, I've talked to innumerable people I know who've had just that experience. And they say, without a person, I wish I had taken extra steps. I thought I was covered. The good thing is with Backblaze, you don't have to think you are covered. You're going to know you're covered. You have access to all of the backed up data with their iOS and Android apps. They have two-factor authentication. So if you really want to lock down your account, you can make it where code is sent to your phone before you can log in. You can do a web restore. And if you need your files immediately, let's say you have a massive hard drive failure, but you want all your files immediately, you can even do what they call a restore by mail, where you can purchase a hard drive that they'll send to you with all your data on it, and they'll overnight it to you from FedEx. And I'm not the only one who's saying this about Backblaze. They have restored over 10 billion with a B files. They have over 200 petabytes of data stored. It is a great offsite addition to local backups, which I do hope you have with external drives and Time Machines. There's no gimmicks, no additional charges, just $5 a month for unlimited, unthrottled offsite backup. Again, Paranormal Podcast listeners get a 15-day free trial at backblaze.com/paranormal. That's backblaze.com/paranormal. Let me tell you something. No backups, now that's spooky. And this is a case where I'm going to tell you, do not stay spooky. Get unspooky. Get Backblaze. Get secured. Get your backups. Get your 15-day free trial at backblaze.com/paranormal. That's backblaze.com/paranormal. Thanks, Backblaze. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. The subject are women in black. The guest is Nick Redfern, and he's written a book about these women in black. It's called, aptly enough, Women in Black, The Creepy Companions of the Mysterious MIB. Nick, some of these things that I'm looking at here kind of remind me a little bit of the Black-Eyed Kids. Any similarities, you know, can I come in, those kind of things. Yeah. Any similarities to the Black-Eyed Kids?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot, actually. I mean, I point this out in the book, how the men in black, the women in black, the Black-Eyed Children, they all have a lot of sort of very close similarities. One is the black clothing, you know, the black suit for the men, the black business suit for the woman, and the kids usually wear black hoodies. And all three are generally described as having sort of pale skin. Now, all three also have to sort of find a way into the home. Most of the men in black reports, you know, they don't force their way in. In fact, I'm not sure if I've got any reports where they've ever forced their way into the house. Instead, they, you know, they've again sort of tried to find a way in, or in some cases almost like hypnotized the witness into letting them in, whereas the women in black, as I said, pretend to be things like census takers, or they're taking a poll in the area, that sort of thing. And the black-eyed children, you know, they often say things like they're lost, or they're homeless, or can they come in and phone their parents. And it seems like with the old vampire legends, that none of these entities can enter the home until you invite them in. You know, they have to find a way for to get the witness to invite them in rather than force their way in themselves. So, you know, I sort of speculate in the book. I don't think it's as simple as, you know, one's the mom and dad and, you know, the black-eyed children of the kids. It's not like that. But I think we could be looking at stuff where they could almost be like shapeshifters. There are a number of cases where the woman in black has sort of morphed into a different form. You know, so I sometimes wonder if we've ever actually seen these things, as bizarre as it sounds, in their real form. And perhaps they can take on different guises depending on the circumstances.
Do you have one of your favorite stories you'd like to share with us from the book? I mean, you have something like 25, 26 stories in this book, but do you have one that really stuck with you and one you might like to tell us a little bit about?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I also mention in the book is that, like with the men in black, you know, they usually turn up in black suits, but occasionally they'll turn up in like military uniforms or something like that. There are a number of cases where it's not just women in black, but women in white turn up, but their actions are identical. And this actually relates to one of the stories in the book. I've got several stories of women in white in the book, but one of them came from a British UFO investigator named Nigel Wright. And in 1997, Nigel was investigating a wave of UFO activity in the English city, in and around the English city of Exeter, which is in the southwest of England. And like a lot of UFO waves, a great deal of other weird stuff was going on as well, like animal mutilations and paranormal phenomena. It kind of paralleled what was going on with Mothman at Point Pleasant in the 60s, where, again, you had sort of a wide range of weird phenomena going on. And Nigel did a number of radio interviews and newspaper interviews, and he brought in a lot of reports. And one of them concerned the weird mutilation of a whale, which had been washed up on the shore not too far from where Nigel lived, overlooking the ocean. And this whale clearly hadn't been killed by, like, the rudder of a boat or anything like that. But there were these sort of large circular cuts on the body that appeared to have been done not at random, you know. And the same area where the whale had been washed up, people had seen this large glowing object rise out of the water and then shoot high into the sky. So Nigel was sort of really very much at the heart of all these investigations. And one day he spent an afternoon at the library, the local library, looking through old newspaper reports, because there apparently had been other waves of UFO activity sort of 50 and 100 years earlier. While he was at the library, his wife, Sue, there was a bang on the front door. She went to the door and there was this woman dressed completely in white and in a very weird outfit as well. It was sort of, she had like almost like cotton white pants and a long white coat. And she sort of like wore one of those kind of skull caps, you know, that the women used to wear in the 1930s when they would go out,
sure,
that sort of tightly,
sure,
fitting hat. She was wearing one of those, totally white, and she was wearing huge, thick, black wraparound sunglasses that looked almost like ski goggles, so you couldn't see any portion of her eyes, couldn't see her head, apart from, Sue said, she could see some black hair underneath the hat just poking through. And the woman essentially threatened Sue and said, tell your husband to keep away from this subject. And Sue said her skin was almost like the color of paper, like a sheet of paper. It was that pale. And it really sort of, you know, upset Sue, destabilized her for a few days. And then Nigel got home and he sort of recognized the significance of this encounter being something that sort of eerily mirrored the men in black. So, you know, that one sort of really stood out in the weird stakes, I guess.
Is there an opinion of people who have seen this? Do they have an overriding opinion of what they've seen? In other words, they say, oh yeah, that's connected to this, or I think that was a ghost, or I think that was a pseudo-governmental official, I think that was an alien. Do people tend to assign women in black to one specific category, say, yeah, that's what I think it is?
Yeah, most people actually don't sort of view it as a governmental thing at all. primarily because of the appearance, which is, as I said, very often quite strange. And most people have, at the very least, suggested that they felt there was some sort of paranormal quality to it. I've got a number of witnesses in the book who felt that because they sort of had, you know, they looked human, but they were pale and had these large eyes and pointed chins. They felt that they were almost like looked like a cross between the, you know, between us and the so-called alien greys. A number of witnesses pointed that out, that, you know, they have these sort of slightly longer than normal heads, pointed chins, larger eyes, even though they've got regular type eyes. They're just larger, pale skin, sometimes shorter, sort of only about 5 feet tall. And bizarrely, in some cases, they wear these long black wigs in bangs. So, you know, the bangs cover right down to sort of their eyebrows and sort of fold in around their cheeks. So if you add to that these wraparound sunglasses, you can barely see the face. And a lot of the witnesses felt that that was the whole point of the camouflage, if you like, was to try and avoid the person seeing what they really look like. So most people, at the very least, put, as I said, like a paranormal angle to it. Others have suggested alien-human hybrids. Some have suggested aliens themselves, you know, just trying to infiltrate us, if you like, in a camouflaged fashion.
Do people fear for their safety?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know anyone who's had a woman in black encounter who views it as a positive experience. Pretty much everybody gets this sort of strange vibe we all get from time to time when you meet someone for the first time, and you just don't know why, but you just get an unsettling feeling about them. You know, we've all encountered that now and again, but everybody who sees the women in black has that kind of sensation and feeling, and that they do sort of instill fear in the person to the point where, you know, they sometimes just go along with the interrogation because they're so fearful for their lives even. And, you know, so it's a very terrifying experience. I don't know anyone who's come out of this not having felt sort of a little bit psychologically played with, you know, or they have this sort of feeling for a few days. A few people, you know, it sort of plunged them into states of paranoia when in the immediate aftermath they've got weird phone calls in the middle of the night, and they pick the phone up and there's this strange chattering or electronic noise. And in several cases, you know, people have been plunged into this state of paranoia where they find themselves peering out of the curtains, wondering if the women in black are going to come back again.
Now, you said that this doesn't happen a lot. I mean, it's something like 20 to 1 or something like that in terms of ratio. But are these increasing as the years go by? Do you see more of them as we go along, or is it about a steady rate?
Well, I definitely get more reports now, but I sometimes wonder if that's not because there's more reports happening, but more people are starting to report them rather than staying quiet. You know what I mean? Or it could be a combination of the two. What I would say is that in most cases, leading up to the publication of the book, most of the reports were older ones, sort of from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And primarily that was because the witnesses just didn't feel comfortable about talking about this. And they actually felt that if they did talk about it, then, you know, they could be in personal danger, so to speak. But there are other cases, I think there's like 7 or 8 in the book, which date from like 2010, literally up until last year. That's the most recent one in the book. And these were ones that where I'd written a couple of articles leading up to the publication of the book to try and get a few more accounts in. And sure enough, a few people did share their experiences, one being a woman in Florida named Denise Stoner. And Denise is an author and an investigator, and she's had her own UFO experiences. And she had a visit one day from a pair of women in black. She actually didn't open the door, but there was this constant knocking on the door. I mean, just, you know, not 3 or 4 times, just endless. And by the time she got to the door, she was, you know, who on earth is this? So she looked through the spy hole, and there were these two almost sort of gaunt-looking, pale women in black both clearly wearing what were fake black wigs, and they had these black eyes, like the black-eyed children. And of course, she refused to open the door, and just, you know, she was terrified. And since publication of the book, I've got three or four new cases, and probably seven or eight that date back to like the 70s and 80s. So, you know, I think it's kind of like with the people in cryptozoology being threatened. It's sort of an untouched subject for the most part, because most people, even in the subject, don't realize it's going on because the witnesses are reluctant to talk about it. And so, you know, it's kind of amazing to think that this far down the line in ufology, 70 years almost after Kenneth Arnold, we're still seeing a new trend surface when we thought we'd seen it all, you know.
In terms of the women in black, and I'm looking at the description here, and you talk about the secrets of alchemy and time travel the supernatural, but in terms of how they travel, are there any clues as to how they get from wherever they are to here?
Well, there actually isn't, and I'll explain why that is the case. It's in the Men in Black cases, you know, not always, but there are a number of reports where they've turned up in sort of old-style Cadillac cars or something like
right.
that. But there are also cases with the Men in Black where it's almost as if they materialize at the front door, and when they leave, they sort of dematerialize at the front door. They vanish almost impossibly quickly. I actually don't have any reports of the women in black in relation to cars, but what I do have is that in almost every case, the women in black sort of impossibly turned up at the doorstep, you know, in the middle of nowhere. One of the cases from the 60s, a farmer, I mean, he lived, you know, literally out in the middle of nowhere at all. And this woman had turned up, and she claimed to be a gypsy, wanted to know if he wanted to buy a few items of jewelry and that kind of thing. And he got this weird vibe from her, and then the conversation got into UFOs. And he told her to leave, shut the front door, and then he got a bit worried, you know, is she going to come back? So he opened the door, and she was gone. And, you know, there was nothing but fields surrounding him. It was his, you know, his farmhouse. So I've got a lot of cases like that where, as bizarre as it sounds, it's almost as if they're not in our reality until they knock that door. And when they leave, they're back to wherever it is they come from.
Well, it's an utterly fascinating subject and something I'd never really thought about. I'm assuming that there's been a great reaction to this book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had some good feedback. The most satisfying feedback is when I get it from people who've had their own experiences and they feel it's helped them because they thought, you know, they'd had a hallucination, or, you know, they felt they were alone and just were going crazy, not realizing that numerous other people had had these own experiences. And, you know, to a degree at least, it did make them feel that they weren't alone. So that's a good thing. And of course, the other angle being, as you brought up, most people simply aren't aware of the fact that this is a real phenomenon. So, you know, it's something very much new, which we don't really see in ufology much anymore. You know, it's very much going over old cases or old aspects of the phenomenon. But, you know, I think to demonstrate to people that there are sort of, you know, there are the cases in the book alone, there's probably 50 or 60 altogether. And they're worldwide as well. You know, it demonstrates that something has very much sort of gone under the radar for a long time, and we're really now only sort of starting to fully get to grips with it.
Well, I mean, you always have such interesting books, and this is just another one to add to the annals that folks should pick up. I've got to say, there's certain authors, you know, I get so many books from publishers and so forth. I'm very grateful, but I have to pass many of them along because I physically don't have room. But I always keep the Nick Redfern books, the Brad Steiger books, Nick Redfern books, the Rosemary Ellen Guiley books. Those are some of the ones that I hang on to. So I really, really like what you do and think you provide such a great service. Where can people get this book and find out more about the Women in Black?
Well, the book, Women in Black, it's published by Lisa Hagen Books. Lisa's my agent, and it's widely available on Amazon right now. And you can also get it from Barnes & Noble as well.
And I know you're always working on new things. So as we speak now in early August, what's next up on the docket?
Well, I've got a new book out with Llewellyn in September called Nessie. It's all about the Loch Ness Monster. But that one sort of covers an alternative angle that hasn't really been done before, in the sense that it looks at a lot of weird paranormal stuff that's gone on at Loch Ness in relation to the monster. Like, for example, Aleister Crowley had a home there, the famous occultist. There have been a lot of UFO activity at Loch Ness. And a couple of Men in Black encounters have occurred at the Loch as well. A famous one involving a man named Ted Holliday, who was a well-known Men in Black, Nessie researcher. And he was intimidated by this weird MIB on the shores of Loch Ness. So it sort of follows a similar path. It's sort of an alternative take on the whole Loch Ness monster phenomenon, tying it in with UFOs, the Men in Black, and a lot of paranormal stuff.
Well, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I am starting a new show called The Crypto Report, which will be on my Plus Club. And guess what? I'm starting it in September. I'd be honored if you'd be our first guest.
Oh, I'll be happy to, Jim. Thank you. Yeah, I'll make sure you get a copy of the book, and I should get my supply, even though it's not out, I think, till September the 8th. I'll probably get my copies within the next couple of weeks. So I'll send one of those as soon as they arrive.
Fantastic. Well, there we have some breaking news. A new show on the Plus Club called The Crypto Report. So if you are a fan of cryptozoology, we're going to be doing that about once a month coming up starting in September with Nick Redfern as our first guest. Nick, thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate having me on. Thanks a lot.
Yet another great conversation with Nick Redfern. We always enjoy speaking with him. And also, you should know that Nick is one of my Paranormal Brain Trust writers over at jimherold.com, and you can go over there and read his stuff, and he is just fantastic. And we'll have a new article this month from Nick, and a pleasure to have him writing for my site as well as many other sites, and he just does a great job. One of the smartest people in the business and the most prolific. Well, we're going to talk shortly with Joshua Shapiro about crystal skulls. But first, this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. I got to tell you, I love Club W because they've done something to wine. And it's not to the formulation of wine, but it's the environment of wine. They've eliminated the snobbery. Normal folks like you and me can now approach wine, learn about wine, enjoy wine, and all that pretense is gone because of Club W. Because they are targeting a new generation of wine drinkers like us who want to do away with all that pretense and just enjoy reasonably priced, great wine. Club W custom tailors wine to the taste of the individual consumer and delivers 3 bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for $39 plus a flat $9 shipping rate. And we've got a great deal for you because the price point for most wines is $20. And by signing up, the link I'm going to give you with Club W, you'll basically be getting your first bottle for free. That's clubw.com/Jim. Now, the thing that I love about Club W is you can access it very easily. You just go online, clubw.com/Jim, take the 20-second palate profile quiz. And by doing that, you have to know zero about wine. It just kind of takes you through based on other things that you enjoy eating and drinking and says, we think you'll like this. And you can start off with those things, or anytime you can go off of that suggested list and get any of their wines. It's really a great way. And the nice thing that I also enjoy about it is that they've got great videos on the wine, so you can learn about the wines without anybody judging you. It's just you and the video. And then when you get the wines, when you get your shipment, you get these neat little cards that tell you about the wine and different pairings and think, boy, you're going to look so smart at your next dinner party. You really are. I'm really enjoying it. We have friends over. Maybe we have a fire pit or something this time of the year. And then we enjoy a nice bottle of wine. Right now I have with me a Pacificana California wine. It's their 2015 Lodi Zinfandel. It says here that it embodies the bold pioneering spirit of the California landscape and all those who call it home. It's a fresh modern take on a classic California varietals for a new generation of wine enthusiasts. Looking forward to that one. And I know you're going to look forward to your Club W membership, so go over to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim to receive a $20 credit on your first order. I think you'll really enjoy it. We've gotten rave reviews, and I think it's about time you do it. So check it out, and always please drink responsibly. And thanks, Club W. One of the more fascinating, maybe less talked about things in the area of the paranormal or the unexplained is that of crystal skulls. One of my first memories were one of the various Arthur C. Clarke television programs. And he had that in the open, they had this great picture of a crystal skull. And I'm like, what is that all about? They've always fascinated me. I don't feel that I've ever quite grokked it or understood what they're all about. And that's why I'm so glad we have our guest today. Now, he has been on our programs before, one of our plus programs, The Other Side, but we've got him back to talk once again about crystal skulls. I'm talking about Joshua Shapiro. He's been involved with crystal skulls since 1983 when he saw his very first one made of amethyst in Northern California. He is the author of various books on the subject, including his first book about crystal skulls entitled Mysteries of the Crystal Skulls Revealed. And he has a more recent book out, for example, Journeys of the Crystal Skull Explorers. And since 2011, he and his divine life partner, Katrina, released the first book in a new series called Journeys of the Crystal Skull Explorers, the Travel Log Series. He's also the co-founder of VJ Enterprises, which has been in operation since 1992, dedicated to sharing the best information that describes how our planet will be transformed into a golden age. And we're going to talk about that as well. Joshua, so glad to have you on the program and excited to talk about crystal skulls.
Thank you so much for inviting me back, Jim. A pleasure to be here.
Well, give us a little bit of, you know, I think most everybody listening has probably seen a picture of some of those famous crystal skulls, but they may not really know what they are. So kind of give us a 101 primer on the history of crystal skulls. When were they first discovered? Where were they first discovered? Talk to us about crystal skulls a little bit.
Okay, sure. The first publicly known crystal skulls came out in, I would say, the middle part of the 1800s. And several of these are now in museums like the British Museum, and there's a museum in Paris, and I know there's another museum in Mexico City that has these crystal skulls on display. But from a historical point of view, I think we have to go all the way back to Lemuria or Atlantis as far as maybe some of the more very advanced or incredible crystal skulls that exist. But of course, that's all theory. So we can only go by what we know historically. And what's been very interesting about the crystal skulls is I would say within the last 20, 30 years, the world has gone crazy about crystal skulls because we have thousands of carvers that are making them now. And it's like for people who are involved on their own spiritual journey, it's like the crystal skull now becomes a tool to help in their spiritual evolution. But primarily, the people who seem to have the greatest knowledge about the crystal skulls are probably various indigenous people, mostly linked with the Mesoamerican cultures, especially the Mayans. But I have talked to some Native American elders who have indicated that they are also familiar with crystal skulls. So I would say, give a higher level detail, I'm believing that many crystal skulls were created in Atlantis. When Atlantis was destroyed, they had many colonies all over the world. The crystal skulls went to those people. They became sacred tools to these indigenous people who have preserved them. And now we're coming across to the modern era where we have all these prophecies going on and prophecies about spiritual transformation of the planet. And the very first crystal skull I saw, which was an amethyst crystal skull in 1983, the message I received, not from the skull, but just a picture of it, was we're returning now to help humanity to create world peace. So obviously, when I'm speaking about crystal skulls, I'm talking about a object made out of, well, originally it was quartz crystals, but now these carvers today are making it out of every gemstone you can imagine that they're making into the shape of like a human bone skull. So this is duplicating these very old crystal skulls that have been found on the ground and in ancient ruins. That's what the modern carvers are doing. And I would say the other key link to the crystal skulls is that they contain an energy field that's around them, which we've been able to test using all different kind of electronic devices. And for most people who call themselves crystal skull guardians like ourselves, they will tell you there seems to be a living consciousness that's working through these skulls, which is, I don't know, it's coming from spirit or other dimensions, difficult to say. But this other consciousness is working with all these different guardians to help them in their spiritual growth or for their spiritual projects. So it's a pretty intense subject that has many aspects to it, which, you know, I've touched on in my overview.
Well, one thing that's interesting to me, when these were first discovered in the 1800s, did they, and I honestly haven't looked as much in into the metaphysical properties of the skulls, but their very existence is fascinating to me, because am I correct in saying that when they were discovered, the initial skulls in the 1800s, that is it accurate to say that there wasn't actually tooling capable of doing what was being exhibited physically in the skulls? Is that accurate or is that inaccurate?
Well, we have to look at it from today and based on the period of time when they were discovered. Today, the modern carvers have diamond tip tools. So we know carvers who can come very close to duplicating a human bone skull.
Right.
However, these tools were not discovered until the 1970s. So the question then becomes, how did these Mayan, Aztec, Mesoamerican people who didn't have this sophisticated type of tools the modern carvers have, how did they make them? Some of the crystal skulls, such as in the case of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull, which is the most well-known crystal skull, is an almost exact duplicate of a human bone skull that came out of Belize in 1924. So that's before 1970. Now, some of the carvers that I've spoken to have told me that there are like generation of families of carvers who had secret techniques that they understood how to cut different type of gemstones, and that there possibly could have existed some techniques to make these very advanced skulls. But if you look at the indigenous people who have them, you know, they don't really have carvers who are making these skulls. It's like, you know, these are sacred artifacts, and they've held them for hundreds or thousands of years. So this kind of gives some credibility to the idea that maybe there were more advanced civilizations in the past, and that, you know, they created these very advanced skulls, and then when their colony, when like Atlantis was destroyed, then they passed them on to these other areas, and then eventually the indigenous people inherited them. So it's very controversial about, you know, how were they made, or I'm not so sure that this question about how they were made is so important. It's more about the energy that surrounds these crystal skulls and the profound changes and effects that it has on people who meet them, especially the older skulls that are connected to these ancient ruins and coming out of the ground or seem to have connection with, you know, these indigenous tribes that maybe acquired them from more advanced cultures. So, but, you know, that has been a question till recently. To the modern carvers have been duplicating, you know, pretty much any type of form of skull you want to create, you know, how were they made and so on. But that doesn't preclude that there weren't some more advanced technologies, like around the Mitchell Hedges skull, working with mediums and channels. They've talked about lasers created through the power of the mind, or that they were gifted to us from the gods, which I guess would be the extraterrestrials. So every theory that you can imagine around the creation of these crystal skulls has been brought up in the 33 plus years that I've been involved in them.
The subject today are crystal skulls. Fascinating stuff. We have a great guest, probably one of the world's foremost experts on the subject. Joshua Shapiro has joined us. And Joshua, now you touched on it in our introduction a little bit, and I've kind of brought it back more to like the physicality of the skulls and how were these created at a time when the tools didn't exist. But let's get back to the metaphysical properties. I mean, there is certainly something when you look at one of these, it's very striking. Now, is it just that it's a pretty artifact and a fascinating artifact, or do you think the skulls themselves are imbued with some kind of metaphysical properties that kind of defy explanation?
Well, I think what's going on, and this is the only explanation that I've been able to come up with, there's two possibilities. And this is mostly linked to the crystal skulls that are made from quartz. There are other skulls made of other gemstones, but it's the quartz skulls that I have the greatest affinity for, so I have to speak from that perspective. Quartz crystal by itself, I believe, has the natural ability to record within itself the vibrational frequency of every single event and activity that happens in its presence. This is just the natural ability of quartz. What happens is if a spiritual medium or a sensitive would pick up on a piece of quartz, they could pick up the histories of things that are around it. However, I think in the case with the crystal skulls, that also what's happened besides this ability to record all these frequencies or mind-to-mind communication seems to be an important part of working with quartz crystal as well, is that the advanced civilizations who made them somehow made them work like living computers, is the easiest way I could say. In other words, it's kind of like a computer where it's recording everything going on, and probably if we had the right technology that maybe they had in Atlantis or Lemuria, we would be able to actually see video images coming from these crystal skulls of, you know, activities that they've recorded. Now, that's not happened yet, but this probably is a soul memory I have from Atlantis. But the other thing, too, is that for most people, as I mentioned before, there's a living consciousness that seems to work through each crystal skull. And this living consciousness is what is, I don't want to use the word control, but let's say deciding what frequencies of energy it's going to share, how it's going to help each person that it sees. So in other words, it almost feels like there's an intelligence that's working through these crystal skulls, which is directing the energies or information or helping people through that. Now, I can't prove that, but it would explain why most crystal skull guardians, after they get their crystal skull or crystal skulls, they eventually come up with a name for them. And this name, sometimes, you know, it's a funny name. It's a common name we would give to a person. And sometimes it's a esoteric name or a name that some of the people don't even know where it comes from. Is it some ancient language or whatever? So I think because of this feature of people feeling to name the skull, it's kind of like honoring that there is this living consciousness or presence inside the skull, because a lot of people are having communication with their crystal skulls. For me, when I have communication from spirit, I hear it in my mind's thinking voice, which is the same voice I hear when I read something. If I try to look at the words, I can't do it. It hurts. But if I hear the words as I'm reading them inside, this is the way that I understand a book. This is the way spirit communicates with me. And this is the way that my personal skulls communicate with me. So I think this intelligence is able to link in vibrationally to who the guardian is or who the person's in front of it that it's helping, and then will communicate with that person using the spiritual gifts they have. So it seems to be a pretty sophisticated process that's going on with the crystal skulls and how they're working with people and communicating with people, considering that it's just a stone that somebody carved in the shape of a human bone skull.
You actually touched on my next question a little bit, but when you think about inanimate objects or what are thought to be inanimate objects that have had some strange effect on their caretakers or their owners. You think about something like the Hope Diamond, which is supposedly cursed its owners. Strangely enough, now it's owned by the United States government, I believe, and is in the Smithsonian. So that makes you wonder about how well our country is going to do. But anyhow, you think about something like that, and it's passed from person to person, and tragedy has befallen them. I'm not saying tragedy, but have there been any strange things? I think you talked about the one thing where the person would name the skull, but people who have possessed the skulls for an amount of time, is there any strangeness that has been associated with those people or their experiences during their time of guardianship?
Well, I would say one of the main phenomena that takes place around the crystal skulls is healing, spiritual healing, I would call it. For example, this amethyst crystal skull, which is known as a me, which for our members of the online membership that we have, I just completed a 3-part series about this skull, discussing my personal experiences and information that was given to me by the former guardians. One of the guardians had a blood vessel that was not growing properly in his head, Mr. Ramirez. And the doctor told him if he was younger, like in his 20s or 30s, they had a surgery they could perform that like 99% work. But being in his 60s or 70s, if they did this surgery to correct this problem, he could become like a vegetable. He decided to go ahead with the surgery. And that's what happened to him. He became like a vegetable. He couldn't think. He could barely speak. But he was able to communicate with his family to put this amethyst crystal skull to the back of his own head on the ground. And he would just sit there thinking, I'm going to be perfectly well. And within a couple of months, he regained all of his abilities. And the medical doctors had no explanation for how he was able to recover that. In another case, there's another crystal skull known as E.T., which is owned by the Van Dieten family. Miss Yoki Van Dieten, I met her in Los Angeles when she first received the skull. We were there together. And after the skull came to her, she was diagnosed with a tumor, like where our third eye is in her by her brain, the size of like a orange. And she felt that the two surgeries that were done with her and her fast recovery was a result because this crystal skull had come into her life prior and helped her, and it's like she had no ill effects from those two major brain surgeries. She fully recovered, and the crystal skull had come. So those are just two very quick examples I can think of with guardians, how the crystal skulls affected people. For me, I remember sometimes when I've been writing books, I'll have one of my crystal skulls right by where I am, and it feels like it creates an energy field around us, and it makes it easier for me to write. You know, it's like sometimes people have writer's block, or, you know, they reach a point where they can't think what else to write. And when the skull was around, I remember when I was doing my book for this Dutch publisher, it was like, you know, immediately how to organize it, what I needed to say for each chapter, it just flowed and it came very easily. So I think the crystal skulls also enhance people's creative gifts or bring out their spiritual gifts. So for me, the true essence of what the crystal skulls represent is a tool that helps us to remember who we truly are as divine children of Creator, revealing, like mirroring back to us our gifts, our ability, our wisdom, our knowledge, our connection to Spirit. And so this is why I think any person who decides to become a crystal skull guardian and finds the perfect crystal skull that resonates for them, not just gets one, but finds one which really resonates with them, you know, they feel good about it, or they feel that the skull needs to go with them, it's going to be a valuable tool to help them in their life in many, many different ways.
Where do you get crystal skulls? I mean, it's not something you go to your local big box retailer and find. Where does one find these skulls and ones that have these kind of properties?
Well, of course, eBay has hundreds of crystal skulls for sale. There are carvers who have their own websites. We, of course, have helped, I don't know how many people, I think over 1,000 crystal skulls since I met Katrina in 2009 have come through us, been prepared by Katrina, who has a special gift to set up the energy of the skulls for the individual. She knows who the individual is and send it out to them. A lot of the spiritual bookstores or centers, some of them are carrying crystal skulls. But, you know, the easiest place would be just any of your listeners, if they feel an affinity to get one, you know, just go ahead and contact us and we can give them some options. We always have a few skulls that are waiting to find their true guardian, or if the individual has certain type of gemstone or size or price that they're looking for, we work with various carvers that we know in China and Brazil, and we can help them. But there are thousands upon thousands of crystal skulls that are being carved every year. And I think that's a sign that this would not be happening unless, of course, number one, people wanted them. And number two, I think it's just a sign of the tremendous energies that they have the potential to hold if they're activated and worked with properly, these new skulls that could assist Mother Earth to raise the vibrational frequency of our planet and bring this world peace that all of us want.
So let's talk about that. On your site, you talk about a golden age. How do you think these skulls may be helping to usher in a golden age, in your view?
Well, first of all, I want to talk about two things that we're personally doing now, which any of your listeners are invited to join us at any time. Number one, on the 13th of each month, we have what I call a Crystal Skull World Peace Meditation. And what's happening on that day is people all over the world are holding one of their crystal skulls, and they're following a meditation that we guide them through to send out a peaceful and harmonious energy. And actually, the idea for this came when I was doing an interview with Uri Geller, the famous Israeli psychic. Sure. He asked me a similar question. He said, you know, okay, fine, we have the crystal skulls. How could they help us for world peace? And I said, well, if we just had people meditating with their personal crystal skull all over the world, I think that this would generate a very powerful energy, because one of the things which the crystal skulls do is they amplify the energy or the thoughts that you're working with at the time that you're working with them. So I have no clue how many people actually join us each time we do. I know on Facebook, we usually have 100 or 200 people who say they're definitely going to join us. But I know that there's a lot more people than that. And then the other thing that came up in 2014 was a group of Crystal Skull Guardians came together and said, you know, what if all the Crystal Skull Guardians would just agree for 5 minutes to do a meditation for peace? What could happen? And that created what was called Crystal Skull World Day, which is going to happen again on November 20th, which is a Sunday. It is set up for four different periods of time. Of course, through our website, people can link into the World Peace Meditation we do, or Crystal Skull World Day. So what my thinking is that people are working with these crystal skulls to send out a loving, healing, positive energy when they're doing their meditation or ceremonies, and that as more and more people do this, it's a geometric multiple of the power of this energy that's being sent. Plus also, too, I think there are many crystal skulls which are not known publicly, that these indigenous people may be guarding, or maybe they're still hidden in the ground, or there is even the possibility that there are other crystal skulls which are not in the physical, they're in the etheric energy network, such as the blue crystal skull, which has spoken to me and had me gone looking for it in Peru a number of times. So I think there's a lot of different levels. And then there's a voice talking to me and saying, don't forget about the descendants of Atlantis and Lemuria who are living in their underground city. Some of them have crystal skulls, as well as the people in the hollow earth. So I just see it as a really powerful tool that's amplifying our thoughts and our emotions in a powerful way to heal the planet. And this is the way in which I think that the part of what the crystal skulls are going to do to create the golden age.
And if people want to get in touch with everything you do and learn more about the skulls and your work with Katrina with these, where can they go on the net?
Okay, well, we're known as the Crystal Skull Explorers. We have a website, a new website we just put up, which is at www.cse, which is like Crystal Skull Explorer. So www.cse.crystalskullexplorers.com. Or they can just send us an email to crystalskullexplorers@gmail.com. These are the two best places. Or, you know, if they go on Google and look up Joshua Shapiro and crystal skulls, they'll find us very easily. Because I've been on the internet since, I don't remember. It's been so long. I guess the early 1990s, I guess. You know, when it first came out, I think we may have had the first Crystal Skull website in the world. So 1985 or 86,
wow.
I think.
Wow. Well, it is a fascinating topic, very mysterious, and thank you for shedding some light on it for us. Our guest today has been Joshua Shapiro, and the subject has been Crystal Skulls. Thanks, Joshua.
Thank you, Jim. A pleasure to be here.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this show as much as I did, and Nick and Joshua, I thank them both for being on the show and taking some time, and thank you for taking some time. And please do rate and review the shows wherever you may listen, whether it's iTunes or the podcasts app, or if it's somewhere else and there's a place to put a rating in, please do. We would certainly appreciate it. It really helps because, as I often say, we don't have a huge marketing budget, but we have something more important. We have great listeners like you. The only way the word's going to get spread is if you spread it. So please do that and tell your friends. In fact, heck, with their permission, take their phone and say, hey, I want to show you something. And navigate them over to the Paranormal Podcast and say, you can listen. You can listen on Spotify. You can listen on iHeartRadio. If you're an Apple person, you can listen on the Podcasts app. If you're an Android person, you can listen on Google Play or hundreds of different apps that download podcasts. So there's no excuse anymore, regardless of what platform they're on. iOS or Android, there is an easy way to listen to podcasts, an easy way to listen to the Paranormal Podcast, and hopefully Campfire too. We thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.